Welcome to Pivoting to Web3 Podcast, where your host and your guests are going to express to you the opportunities and limitations of Web3 technologies, where they win, and sometimes it could be a downward spiral. So check in with Pivoting to Web3Podcast.com and stay abreast on what's happening now. And here's your host, Donna Mitchell. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to Pivoting to Web3 Podcast. This is Donna Mitchell, and our guest today is Jamelia Greer, Dubai-based international technology lawyer, podcast host, and CEO and founder of Bytebal Consulting. Helps businesses achieve success in law and emerging technology in an interconnected world. With over 15 years of international legal experience spanning from China, Singapore, and Dubai, Jamelia has held roles such as the Global Head of Data and Privacy Operations at Standard Chartered Bank in Singapore and Vice President of Legal Compliance at Marriott International in Shanghai. The U.S.-raised Mandarin-fluent Black mother of four is committed to empowering businesses with borderless technology and making advanced technology accessible to all. Through her company and her podcast, Barely Legal in Web3, Jamelia is at the forefront of the legal, technological, Web3, and global market conversation with her mission to create a positive social impact and global scale. Now, with that said, I want you to know it is a privilege and an honor to meet Jamelia because she has done some of the most impactful work, and all of her experience right now is here to share with us at Pivoting to Web3 Podcast. So welcome, Jamelia. How are you today? And say hello to our audience.
Donna, first and foremost, I wanted to say thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here, and I am super excited about this conversation, and I look forward to the discussion.
I'm super excited about this conversation as well. I have been wanting to talk to somebody, and somebody that's impressive, experienced, and having all the global background in the area of emerging technology. And you know, I'm going to want to definitely get into the Web3 of global technology. So tell us, how did you end up pivoting into legal at the intersection of Web3 and all these technologies? How did that happen?
Wow. Well, it's been a long time coming, but I guess the short story is that I'm a lawyer by trade, and I've been practicing for about 15 years now, originally from Connecticut. And I've always had roles that were really about data and technology. So whether that came in the form of trade compliance and really trying to control technical data in the aerospace and defense industry, or controlling the data flows of an app such as the Marriott Bonvoy app when I worked at Marriott International. It's always been about this technology and data, and it's always been so fascinating to me. And I think I got to the point in my career where I said, you know what, there's too much going on. There's too much exciting stuff happening in the world of technology. And I decided to make the big leap out of corporate and start Bytebal. And really just go headfirst into Web3. And it's been an amazing journey so far, but there's just so much happening at the intersection of law and technology.
So with that said, with law and technology, I'm really curious to know, with all the borders you have crossed in your travels, how does cross-border legal challenges impact the Web3 space? How does that impact the businesses, entrepreneurs, or those brands that are looking at or starting to onboard in Web3?
That's such a good question. You know, I think there's this misconception that because we're operating on a blockchain, that data is somehow everywhere, right? We have this mystical idea of a blockchain that is omnipresent And therefore, you know, borders are not part of the consideration when it comes to legal requirements. And that couldn't be further from the truth. The truth is that that actually complicates matters. When you're dealing in what we like to call the Web 2 space or the traditional space, we operate with servers. And servers are based in locations, or we operate from cloud technology, and it's a bit more tangible for us to really understand where technology or where data is housed. When you transition into sort of this idea of a blockchain, then the question becomes, well where's the data? It's on the blockchain, but where is that, right? And so now we're learning how to make these different connections. And it is more challenging for businesses, I would say, because they have to really think about where they're going to set up their headquarters and register and what that means for their business in terms of their compliance obligations.
So with that said, and everything that's happening in the technology in the Web3 and the applications and where they set up their headquarters, when one is doing that, what other challenges take place or have you seen in some of the projects or trying to get things up and running and implemented? Are there any specific challenges that people should be aware of that you can give some additional insight on?
Absolutely. I think founders really struggle with where they want to start in terms of if they are creating a global operation, where is that first country where they create a legal entity? And why do they choose that country? And unfortunately, because the United States has had such a, you know, push and pull relationship with the acceptance or embracing of cryptocurrency, many American Web3 founders are looking to set up abroad. They're really looking to take all of the business out of the United States and place it in a country or a jurisdiction where the regulations are more transparent, they're more clear, and quite frankly, they're more crypto friendly, as they say, or they're just more warm to the idea of digital assets industry in general.
So now we're really coming into, is that the reason why smart contracts and some of the other areas in the United States, there's that push and pull and tension? It's like people want to get involved, or they change their mind because if something happens with the contract, there isn't any governance. Can you expand on what you would see to be a possible solution to a situation like this? What would be the wish list, or what would make sense? What would you recommend, if possible, to smooth this over? Because all of us are walking around that are in the Web3 space trying to figure out what to do. But meantime, it's like, you know, the Wild Wild West, because there's no governance. In some ways. So you can't have it both ways, but how do you see the future really panning out in this situation?
It's a really good point, Donna. I think the initial thought is that founders should really consider what their business is and what aspects or, you know, parts of Web3 technology as we know it, they would like to incorporate into their business. And how would they like to incorporate those parts? Mm-hmm. So would they like to launch NFTs? Are they looking to incorporate tokens? If so, you know, what type of tokens are they, and so on and so forth. And to get really clear about what their business model is, because at the end of the day, the main concern that most American founders have is this a security? It's the question you hear every single day. Is it a security? If it is, am I going to jail? And I had a really good conversation with Securities and Exchange Commissioner Hester Peirce in January about this, which was, you know, founders are leaving. The technology is leaving the U.S. because we have a gap. There is a lack of direction. And, you know, the SEC, at least parts of it, acknowledge that there is that gap. And so the conversation, as you rightly pointed, has to be, well, what should they do? And I think they really need to start thinking globally. And when things change and become a bit more clear in the United States, they can always pivot, as you would say, and come back to the U.S.
So in many ways, those businesses that are thinking about onboarding or attempting to use tokenizations in the United States and have global offices, is that a rational business decision right now? Or is that really taking a risk and you open yourself up to a lot of risk? And how do you mitigate that risk?
I hate to give the lawyerly response, but it depends. It depends on how they're using their tokens. And really, at the end of the day, what is the impact that they're trying to have? You know, we've seen a lot of really good progress for sort of social impact projects that are focused on things like animal conservation, where if you want to adopt an endangered species animal, you can. And your donation is shown in the form of an NFT. And so that's not really a security at all. It's really just, I've given a donation and I want, you know, an NFT of this animal afterwards. And so that's pretty cut and dry. And we can probably say pretty safely, that's not really the type of security, or that's not really a security at all. But then when you get to the other business models of, you know, using tokens to do sort of real-world asset tokenization and things of that nature, then you start to question, well, is this, you know, is this something that's closer to a security? So I think it's really a case-by-case basis on whether a company should really even consider going abroad.
So with my audience and a lot of the listeners, they're still learning the Web3 space and the lingo and NFTs and tokenizations and smart contracts. And I guess my question is, for those that are listening that may want to know, what are the different types of tokenizations? You said it depends. Can you provide maybe a delve into that a little bit more so it's a little bit clearer if someone's listening and never really knew that there was different types of tokenizations? Can you express that since you're in the legal field as best possible? Thank you.
Sure, absolutely. So one example of tokenization that's become really popular now is real-world assets. And I like to give the example of real estate, for example. And there are a couple of companies out there, a few companies out there that are actually doing this right now, although they're doing it in very different ways and different legal structures. But the concept is that, let's say there's a house, there's property, and the objective is to tokenize it, which is to fractionalize it. So you can think of it as shares, right? And this is where we get into the great area of security. So to take the house and to divide it up into different interests, and then to sell those interests. And so that would be what we call the tokenization of a property. And every house or every property is somewhat different, right? So they're unique in their format. So that's one example of tokenization involving a real world asset such as real estate. Another example would be commodities. And I think this is also really interesting as well, because commodities are commodities, we know, right? Corn, grain, gold, and so on and so forth. But there are projects that are looking to essentially tokenize something like a commodity and to have it be, if you own a bar of gold, you're not really having the physical bar of gold in your possession. You're having a token, which represents the bar of gold. And the bar of gold is housed in a secure location. And so there are all these really new, interesting business models that are coming up to use tokens as a reflection of ownership of a piece of a unique piece of property or a piece of a commodity.
So when they have this piece and they have the tokenizations, is it something they can sell down the line and transfer the value? Or is there a difference depending on the tokenizations or the type of token or the type of NFT? Where are the governance boundaries if they're available, not in the United States, but in other countries? Like right now, I think you're in Dubai. Is that correct? In that area?
That's right.
So there must be some benefits or some differences culturally or depending on the country, and we're back into the legal side again. Can you help us with that?
Right. Most of these business models would have an incentive to allow for a purchaser to resell or otherwise transfer that initial asset. So they've initially bought it and then they want to sell it again on a secondary market. Mm-hmm. That's where the business can actually scale, because if you buy something from a platform and then you resell it to me, presumably the business would get some sort of revenue from a transfer fee. And so we're using their platform, presumably. And so that's a great business model. But the question becomes for U.S. businesses is, once again, is that a security, right? And so we keep hitting the same brick wall. What's interesting as you get outside of the United States is there's much more clarity around the do's and don'ts. There's much more clarity around how digital assets can be created, how they can hold value, how they can be transferred and resold. And you see a lot of that in Dubai, particularly. In Dubai, we have the Virtual Assets Regulatory Authority, which has some pretty clear regulations around digital assets. We also see it in the British Virgin Islands, where there are some regulations there as well, where that if you are creeping into that area of, is this a security, there's licensure requirements. Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting is that the United States has not yet created a separate digital assets regulatory framework. They're still leaning on the old regulatory framework of securities. And so the question becomes, is that still applicable?
Yeah, there's a lot of questionings becoming at this time on what's happening or not happening and when it's happening and if it's going to happen. But we won't go there. That would probably be another podcast. So I appreciate that answer. So with that said, how is AI, it's an emerging technology. It's something that's really happening here more so in the U.S. versus the Web3. But are there any legal compliance issues that the other countries have dealt with that the United States has not dealt with as well? Like in the Web3, it seems that we're falling behind. There's a gap. And in comparison, how is that in comparison to what's happening in AI, in the machine learning and everything that's taking place in that space? Are we falling behind? Is there a gap there as well, or are we ahead in that area?
Unfortunately, I do think that the U.S. is falling a bit behind in terms of creating very thorough regulations for emerging technology such as AI. We've seen that EU has come up with at least a framework for AI regulation, and other countries also are proceeding to do the same. The question it always is why? Why is that, right? And so we sort of have this balance between innovation and compliance, where the market wants to innovate, the market wants to create, they want to build new businesses, but unfortunately the political framework cannot keep up with that. And I think that's definitely something that we should look forward to seeing resolved in the next administration, hopefully.
So thank you. That gives additional insight. So what about AI and the Web3 environment? How do you see that having an impact, or is DeFi having more of an impact with those technologies in the underserved and underprivileged populations? I guess my question is the benefits to that. But from a legal standpoint, where does that intersection really open a path? And where are the challenges that really kind of close it down?
Well, I've definitely seen that AI is providing a lot of resources for underserved populations in terms of being able to build more quickly. And we've seen that with some of the open source code and the open source resources that are out there for people really to just use those in order to be entrepreneurial and to build their business. It will be interesting to see how far that AI advantage goes in Web3. for example, in building out smart contracts, how much can AI actually do to give a low-code founder a leg up? And I think it will just be a matter of time for us to really be able to see the long-term benefits of AI in serving underrepresented populations in Web3 or in other emerging tech fields.
So with education, do you see education playing a role for mass adoption or in the governance space, or what should we be doing? I feel like we need to be doing more. I initially ended up doing this podcast, you know, because I thought everybody needed to know what was happening. I just kept digging. Then I learned so much. And then there was so much over my head. But I figured what I learned would be a value and a benefit to anyone. And they could learn from me what I learned. And at the end of the day, it just seems like education plays a key role. And the ability to be agile and change or keep up, it just seems like we're missing some of the dynamics that are necessary to be successful, not only as a nation, but as a culture. And it appears to me that if we all, you know, wrapped arms in the regulatory space globally, wouldn't we be able to accomplish more? Is there any benefits to that line of thinking?
It's certainly a sort of a utopian sort of thought there. You know, this generation, the generations that are coming out now have so many different challenges. And I tend to think that those challenges distract them from a lot of the opportunities that are present. Web3, the biggest challenge in people learning about it is education. And then you start to say, well, why? Why are people not learning about Web3 the way that they should? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's because people don't see themselves represented in the space. And so we're back to these sorts of legacy challenges of not enough women, not enough people of color in technology or in law or in business. How do we diversify the space even more? And while there is this narrative that Web3 will be the great equalizer, cryptocurrency will be the great equalizer to offer more banking opportunities for people of color, we're just not seeing it yet. And, you know, podcasts like this that, you know, give educational resources and also give information to people who otherwise wouldn't have it are great. And it's a step in the right direction.
Well, this has been a real eye-opener. And I'd also like to just cover off on a couple of other things very quickly. You have traveled, you have embraced, you've been in leadership. And I'm sure as you've traveled and learned and experienced, you've had societal impact. What are some of the greatest achievements in your time and in your tenure that you like to share, and what was the, the motivation, and how did you get there?
Wow, that's such a great question. You know, as you asked the question, I could think of actually small achievements that had a great impact on me, and not necessarily those public sorts of moments where you're on a stage accepting an award, but the smaller ones where you have an impact on one person's life. And I'm reminded of when I first went to China many years ago to teach English in a college program. It was my first trip abroad, and it was back in 2000. And I befriended my students. I didn't speak any Chinese at the time, but I had taken on this program because it was about conversational English. And of course, I'm a native English speaker. And building that human connection with someone who had never seen an American, definitely never saw a Black American, had never even spoken English to a native English speaker, although they had been studying the language their entire life. And they were able to form their own ideals about me as an individual, and I was able to actually overcome some of the biases that I had been taught from the US standpoint about what it was like to live in China and what that experience should be like. And that probably was such an impactful experience to me, because I realized at that point is that there's so much out there in this world that we don't know. And even when it comes to technology, we think about how we use technology to bring people together. At some point, we do need to come back to that social impact. Is that how are we impacting one person's life? Yes, we want to scale. We want to be super impactful. But are we having real impact on one person? That's really where I think the greatest goodness comes in.
Well, what an awesome answer. And just some additional insight on, and what gives, what's better than giving, rather, and giving to another individual. I know in my travels, when I was young and overseas for an international program, you're right, that opened my eyes to some of the things that I was told, and that's not what I saw, and that was not my experience, and it has been one of the best experiences of my life. So lastly, if you had to say anything about the future or your goals or objectives or your wish list, what is it you haven't seen or experienced or think should be available? Or what direction may you want to see society or certain populations or maybe regulation or compliance, anything that's rolling in the back or sometime late at night, you think about it and say, boy, I wish we just do this. Or mankind can really veer off the tracks. We've got all this technology. We've got all this happening. If we just did this, what would that this be?
Such a great question. You know, BiteBow's mission is to protect and promote Web3 for good, for social good. And I think that we need to go back to the basics of technology for social good. And one of the initiatives that we're embarking on this year is an HBCU initiative, which is a historically Black college and university initiative, to bring those students out of the U.S., and to expose them to two things. Number one, a global experience. And number two, technology in a foreign land. So it really is opening their mind to the potential of opportunity that is beyond the borders that they're used to. And not just beyond borders, but beyond how other cultures are experiencing and using the same technology. So that's really my goal and my mission with BiteBow, and we hope to continue down that road and going for B Corp certification this year or next year. We're pushing forward.
Well, that's an exciting time. How can people reach out to you and connect with you? And is there anything else you'd like to share that I didn't think to mention or ask?
No, I think, first of all, people can find me on LinkedIn. I'm at LinkedIn at Jamilia Greer, and Twitter, same handle, my name. And really, if people are interested in learning about this sort of mission for technology for social good, they can find anything about BiteBow at bitebow.io online.
Well, thank you, Jamilia. I am just excited that we were able to meet, honored to have the time with you, that we're shaping tomorrow together. And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Pivoting to Web3 Podcast, Shaping Tomorrow Together. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Pivoting to Web3. At pivotingtoweb3.com, make sure you hit the subscribe button so that it gets to you with every episode that comes out. We have lots of great opportunities, limitations, and downward spirals being revealed by our guests. And thank you in advance for all your reviews and comments. I appreciate you so much. I look forward to serving you in the next week's episode.